Are you ready to dive deep into the intersections of technology, law, and business? Catch the Tech Intersect podcast on our new Advantage Evans YouTube channel. Whether you're connecting on the go or binging episodes from the comfort of your home, you'll never miss a moment again. Plus, you'll experience all types of exciting shorts, special events content, breaking news lives, and the comprehensive learning series. Subscribe today, hit the bell for notifications, and enjoy podcast videos and more. Use the link or search for Advantage Evans on YouTube to find our channel so you can watch, learn, and engage where insider meets impact. See you there.
You know, technologists go out and talk about the excitement about the technology and people don't get it. So that scares them. You have, of course, we both know regulatory concerns that will work out over time, taking a little bit longer here in the United States because we're causing our own pain. But this, you know, volatility, those high profile hacks and scams, all of those things are really keeping people from at least leaning into education. But that's why I work. And this takes folks like us who I am not encouraging you or discouraging folks from doing it. I think that they should lean in, learn about it, and start to acquire this new asset class. But I just want them to have the right information so they make good choices from the prudent investor standpoint. And that's why I still believe so strongly in the power of self-determination, the power of financial privacy, and that one day we will have this global asset where it doesn't depend on borders. Welcome to Tech Intersect. I'm your host, Tanya Evans, and my life and work exist at the heart of law, business, and technology. Yeah, I've earned a few fancy titles and degrees over the years, but the bottom line is I'm a writer, speaker, teacher, and lifelong learner, and I'm really excited that you've joined me on this journey. So what is Tech Intersect? Well, it's authentic, empowering conversations with really interesting guests who demystify complex topics to prepare you for the future, because your future is now, and it exists where law, business, and tech intersect. Get ready to listen, learn, and leverage. Let's get started. Hey, everybody, this is Professor Tanya Evans. Welcome to another episode of Tech Intersect. This is a very special series for the lead up to the release of my book on October 24th. It is Digital Money Demystified, and I've enjoyed the process from the side of the author, but now I am flipping the mic with some of my near and dear friends in the crypto space, some of the stalwarts, some of the OGs who actually ask me questions that originate either from myths in the book or our journey together, and I'm very, very excited to have Caitlin Long on with me today. I'm handing the mic over to her. She will introduce herself, and then she's going to ask me all the fabulous questions, and we will engage in conversation so that we help you on your crypto journey. And so we'll talk about all of that and more in a moment. But first, Caitlin, welcome.
Hey, it's my honor, Professor Evans, to be here. You and I have been working together for more than a few years, and we finally met at South by Southwest, and we connected over all of the regulatory work that I was doing, you were super interested in. And what interested me about you was that you have an intellectual property background. And I hadn't seen an attorney with an intellectual property background come into this space until I met you. So tell us about your journey and how did an intellectual property specialist come across and fall in love, go deep down the rabbit hole on Bitcoin and crypto?
Absolutely. It's so fascinating because that is the perfect question, because my entry into the space really was as a law professor and as an administrator to figure out what this technology, this magic internet money and its underlying technology, what it meant for the next wave of lawyers. And so my origin story really begins at the intersection of my curiosity about the space as it relates to my practice, my long-term practice and my teaching as an intellectual property lawyer. I remember it was 2017, actually, and I was in New Hampshire at the time. We first met, I can't remember if we first met at South By. I think it was South By that led to us connecting in New Hampshire, because I knew that you were coming into the area and you invited me to a dinner. And so that was a really, really exciting time to connect with you as well and learn everything that was going on in the Bitcoin space, in particular in New Hampshire, because it was this thriving place. We had like Bitcoin Row in Portsmouth, really, really exciting stuff at the time. But in, at the, like, it's like the fall of 2017, I'd heard
about Bitcoin, but I don't have a technology background. I'm not a computer scientist. I'm not a financial whiz. And in fact, I have learned more about finances in the last 6 years than I did for all of my education. And that is having a patent attorney for a mother and a surgeon for a father, attending Northwestern University, traveling the world as a professional tennis player, having nothing to do with science or technology, you know, being well-traveled. Oh, there's a fun fact. See, we continue to get to know. So, side note, I played on scholarship in Northwestern, and then I played professionally from 91 to 95 before going to law school. So, our conversation right now is during the U.S. Open. So, this is like the only thing I get to do now is watch TV and do these interviews.
I love it. Hey, my boo actually played at the U.S. Open. He lost in the first round.
Me too.
But as a junior. Oh my gosh. Okay. All right. So we've got more to talk about off screen. But exactly. All right. So how is it that tennis players ended up here too? That's so funny.
Right. That's probably the better question.
Yeah.
Right?
How did you end up in intellectual property in the first place? Like, what was it? What was the foundation that brought you to this? Because you didn't just arrive here, right? All of us are where we are because of our paths that we've taken in life. So talk about that a little bit as well.
Absolutely. Well, it's interesting because I have parents who are science background folks, but I'm really the athlete and the intellectually curious and also creative. And I grew up in Philadelphia. And at the time, neo soul, a style of music was coming out of Philadelphia, talking like music soul child, Jill Scott. I also, another fun fact is I was a performance poet. I would work all day at large firms. I started at big firm life. I was at Drinker, Biddle, and Reith at the time. I think they've changed their name since then. You know, I clerked in a Third Circuit. Like, I did all of these check the box things as a lawyer.
Yeah.
Worked at Drinker and then Pepper, and I would work forever from forever to forever. But at night, I'd go to the local coffee shop and perform poetry. And so I have this love for the written and the spoken word as well, and protecting creatives at the time. And so even my first entry point with respect to intellectual property, I wrote this article in 2018, because this connects to your second question. In 2018, I wrote an article. It was one of the first, if not the first, but maybe let's say one of the first, because I want to be accurate. It was CryptoKitties, Cryptography, and Copyright. And I was getting a lot of questions at the end of 2017, the beginning of 2018, about this burgeoning environment that was the Ethereum ecosystem and EVM. Right. And people were starting to experiment with building decentralized applications, decentralized autonomous organizations as well, and other projects and things that, you know, the stuff that the EVM and Ethereum ecosystem is made of, but they were not clear about how to monetize it because they were building on top of open source software. So they were asking IP attorneys in general, and most of them didn't know what the hell they were talking about. And I just had this curiosity personally and professionally to fall in. That was the impetus for me to learn more. I had to learn about the underlying technology in order to answer those questions. And so that's really, I remember going into my room and every question, as you know, leads to the next 10 questions. And that's kind of my story of getting involved.
That's so interesting, because I remember listening to a podcast on CryptoKitties and everyone laughed at them. And I remember thinking at the time, all this technology is digital collectibles. And what makes Beanie Babies a collectible? It's purely subjective. So these CryptoKitties were digital versions of Beanie Babies, and obviously they sort of had their rise and fall as Beanie Babies did, but is it really that different if it's digital? How do you answer that from the perspective of an intellectual property background?
Yeah, it's really interesting, because when I think of copyright law in the United States, really, it hasn't, well, I mean, we've had some updates over time, but really, we're still applying, or the courts are still applying, the 1976 version of that act that barely took into account the technology of that time, let alone what has transpired since. And so we've had tweaks and amendments to address technological innovation, but we're still trying to fit a square peg into a round hole in many ways. But that being said, that is the law that we have. And so, you know, unless and until there is something wholly new, this is what we have, and you have to put it together. And a lot of the questions that we've asked now, the first questions about the application of copyright law in particular, and patents and trademarks to a lesser extent, happened with the boom of the internet. And so there are a lot of national and international laws, rules, treaties, conventions that apply to digital technology and digital assets. And so we kind of have a blueprint, yet it still isn't perfect for the technology and how it's advanced from this point in time. Because to your point about maybe like non-fungible tokens and how you have the subjective value of certain individual things, we have both the asset that is the token that serves, in my mind, roughly like the deed to a home. It's not the home, but it is a way to exercise control, connection to a range of things, whether that additional asset is digital or some type of physical experience or physical project. Like, it's just not a neat fit anymore. But, you know, I say all that to say still the law that we have is the law that applies in terms of things that are created, original. It gets harder and harder to have originality. It gets hard to enforce copyright, but we had all of those problems with digital technology before this. And I think that this technology, particularly with NFTs, not only for creative stuff, but also for identity and other areas, is really going to play an important role in advancing both not only technology, but the law to keep pace.
Has there been much litigation over copyright violations involving NFTs and the like yet?
That's interesting, because the short answer is that is just starting to emerge, okay, especially because no one cared about the technology or the impact until the last surge of value.
Right.
When you had these remarkable or unremarkable or in between. I have no subjective value, but just saying people are paying a lot of money for things in the same way that, you know, I have some great art and it's subjective, right?
Correct. It's all subjective.
But, and so you put that in digital form. Yeah. We have a lot of problems in the digital space because you are able to obviously capture some type of screenshot, then you can tokenize it and sell. And so, but the same rules for notice and takedown for some of those centralized marketplaces, they have to take down that art while there's some litigation. The trouble is also identifying where people are.
Of course.
And so that is something that we'll have to work through over time. And that's not gotten any easier. Yep. The one great thing about the community, though, is you can go and grab an Aku NFT, but try and sell that with a robust community that knows it's a fake or tells people on crypto Twitter or the platform formerly known as Twitter. Nobody's buying it. And so it impacts the value. So you have to have street cred, community acceptance in order to sell it for anything of significance. So I feel like the marketplace and the community is that last bastion in terms of the check, because nobody's going to buy it if you already know and it's out on social media that it's a fake.
Well, and that leads us to another discussion, which is a big point of your book, especially with your book coming out now after we've just seen a horrific period of the fraud at FTX and bankruptcies of intermediaries who were clearly scamming people. And there are just horrific stories of consumer fraud that just break your heart. And yet you and I are still at it. Absolutely. What keeps you going? And tell us about, in your book, how you defend against the good parts of this industry while acknowledging that there are bad and that a crackdown needs to happen.
Yeah, because, you know, it's the concept or the idea that two things definitely can be true. When you think about the horrendous scams, rug pulls, the trial that's coming up with Sam Bankman-Fried in the fall, and you think of some of the failures of the banks and the shell games that have been going on, that's really the old game with the latest technology.
Right.
So you can tack on this idea of it being crypto. What is involved with crypto when someone is literally enticing people onto an exchange and then misappropriating their funds for some nefarious purpose that have nothing to do with crypto, that has nothing to do with the underlying technology. In fact, it's not using the underlying technology, except to the extent that it's the shiny object that attracts people to an old school scam like Lehman, like Madoff, like all of the other things where people are not aware of what is happening behind the scenes and there's some high stakes games. That being said, we both know there are a ton of scams. Wherever there's an opportunity to make significant gains, there will be a scam. In the last 7 days, I've had two credit card not present impacts to two completely different accounts. In the last 7 days, I've never actually had a crypto issue happen for me. I treat it 100% in the ownership model of having my own wallets and spreading them out, et cetera, et cetera. rather than relying on centralized exchanges. So when you get enough people who don't know enough and get burned, and you have all of the fear, uncertainty, and doubt, also known as FUD, injected into the market intentionally to separate folks from the future and their own autonomy and their own self-determination, financial privacy, that is a perfect storm for people being blocked by the one thing that will keep them from participating and being empowered by the space, and that's education.
Right.
And so that's why I continue to work so hard. That's why I know you continue to work so hard to push past this myth, for example, of that this is just a bubble waiting to burst, for example, or it's every crypto is a scam. It's like over 30,000 different types of coins and tokens. They can't all be coordinated as one big giant scam, right? The misunderstandings and lack of knowledge. I think a lot of people are afraid by this. So the way I describe it is you have like technology and finance and they have a baby. And then we put some cryptography on top of it.
That's a good way to put it.
And nobody knows what the hell we're talking about when a technologist, right? Yeah. You know, technologists go out and talk about the excitement about the technology and people don't get it. So that scares them. You have, of course, we both know regulatory, I have to take a breath there. Regulatory concerns that will work out over time. Taking a little bit longer here in the United States because we're causing our own pain. But this, you know, volatility, those high profile hacks and scams, all of those things are really keeping people from at least leaning into education. But that's why I work. And this takes folks like us who I am not encouraging you or discouraging folks from doing it. I think that they should lean in, learn about it, and start to acquire this new asset class. But I just want them to have the right information so they make good choices from the prudent investor standpoint. And that's why I still believe so strongly in the power of self-determination, the power of financial privacy, and that one day we will have this global asset where it doesn't depend on borders. We spend a lot of time paying a lot of taxes to prop up borders. We will live in a world at some point that doesn't honor that. And that is scaring the bejesus out of the status quo.
The powers that be. Yeah, right.
It's not a matter of if, but when.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Dr. Tanya M. Evans, author of Digital Money Demystified. And I want to let you know that to stay on the leading edge of any opportunity, especially investing, you have to empower yourself with the tools and resources needed to keep your knowledge and skills current. And if you're relying on last year's information or even last month's, look, you're already behind. Sure, you can try to figure this out on your own at YouTube University. The problem is, it's difficult to separate fact from fiction with so many carnival barkers banking on your inexperience. And of course, there are the naysayers, usually from legacy finance, banking on your fear while they quietly help their high net worth clients to invest. All of it muddies the waters when all you want to know is how to get in safely, legally, and confidently so you're not left behind. That's why I wrote Digital Money Demystified, where I take the top 10 crypto myths head on and give you well-researched, well-supported facts to empower you to make good choices out there in the new digital cash economy. As a law professor who developed the first blockchain crypto and law online certificate program, a retail and corporate crypto policy and education trainer, and a thought leader appearing regularly on national media, I've done the heavy lifting so you don't have to. Look, there are plenty of books and courses on which crypto assets to invest in. Digital Money Demystified is the book you read before you dive into those. So head to digitalmoneydemystified.com to learn more and prepare for the future of money and wealth today.
You love listening to podcasts, but have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? Maybe you want to build a brand, grow your business, or are looking for an excuse to talk about your favorite hobby. Whatever your reason for making a podcast, Buzzsprout is the place to start. Since 2009, Buzzsprout has helped over 300,000 people launch their own podcasts. Buzzsprout walks you step by step through the whole process and will give you powerful tools to start, grow, and monetize your podcast. Ready to get started? Click the link in the show notes to get our free step-by-step guide to starting your podcast today.
That was already where I was going to go next in our conversation. This is all very global, and yet the laws are very local. They recognize borders, right? Whether it's a town, a county, a state, right. or a country. But now the internet itself has always been global. And what has happened with this technology is that value can now be transferred across borders, whereas it was just information before. And so talk about right. that. How does law enforcement deal with the fact that this is global? And probably most of the horrific scammers are not in the same country as the people who are being scammed. And by the way, they right. do that by design because it's more difficult for law enforcement to go after them. So talk about how regulation evolves mm-hmm. where law enforcement has the powers that they need to have to go after criminals.
Right. Because at the end of the day, both you and I believe very strongly in the protection of consumers and investors. Yes. That this is all, and every great actor in the space mm-hmm. wants the same thing. So it's not about making space for criminals. No one wants criminals in the space who are impacting value. Ultimately, that impacts value and does a huge disservice to the community and an extreme harm to people, as you've mentioned earlier. This technology, because it is so transformative, also requires nation states to take a hard look about how we've mm-hmm. done things in the past, because the world seems to exist and be built upon hyper competition, and it will require more coordination and collaboration than most countries are comfortable with doing, because you have so many different leaders and different methods of leadership. It's going to require a lot of leaders to actually see that each individual space, and we'll still call it countries or divided by borders, is going to need to rely on others in order to enforce. That assumes that nation states right. actually want to do that. And the ones that do, in terms of coordination, will have to be stronger than the ones that don't, to isolate those who would be involved in nefarious activity. And we know, you know, the laundry mm-hmm. list of countries involved in that, to be sure. But it's going to take a coordinated effort and a collaborative effort in the same way that right. they did with the internet. But your point is well made. Everybody was like, information wants to be free and we want to send information quickly. Oh, wait a minute, not value, though, because value, we're going to need to control right. that. And that's why we see so much pushback, in particular in the United States. We're like, we don't want you messing with the greenback. We got a good thing going here. And this magic internet money sounds like it's a thing. And the interesting thing, and you know this too, the government, oftentimes this type of technology originates with the government. They already know everything there is to know. Many people, either they're playing dumb or really don't know, like the ones out in front that we have to rely on to make rules, the law, the legislative body that creates, you know, the legislation that creates agencies and empowers agencies, I should say, all of that. But there are enough people who know what's going on. And oftentimes this technology originates with the government. Now it's becoming more mainstream and it's become problematic when folks like you and I are out there saying, hey, wait, yeah. there's a different way to bridge from TradFi into the future. And that we're just at a critical point right now where that is really upending the status quo in a way that is creating shockwaves as more and more people start to figure out that this is a possibility.
Well, and that leads to maybe the last topic to discuss, which is balancing privacy with the legitimate needs of law enforcement to enforce property rights against the criminals who are committing fraud and scams on consumers. How do we strike that balance? Because again, you have an IP background. How did the internet strike that balance? Mm.
A lot of updates to the Copyright Act in particular had to occur to allow for the support of the innovation, because the governments, both here in the United States and around the world, decided this was an important thing. This was going to be important to support and bolster trade and communications, really open up things, open up markets, but not to the extent of value going from hand to hand from on a peer-to-peer basis. But certainly it was going to empower nations for a whole range of things. And so there was this coordinated effort around the world. But here in the United States, you had to have the ability for like the YouTubes of the world. It reminds me of like Napster and Grokster, where there had to be this balance between technology that was allowing for peer-to-peer exchange, then of, for those who won't be able to see, file sharing. As an IP lawyer, most of that was not only mm-hmm. unauthorized file sharing, but a lot of copyright infringement, but some tremendous non-infringing uses. Sure. So we had the great case, the Sony Betamax case, that that was really instrumental in identifying that you could have both infringing and non-infringing uses of a device. And it wasn't the device that was the problem, but what people were doing with it. And we can borrow a lot of language from that era when we're going through Napster, Grokster. I'm like, BitTorrent is still around. Technology is still here. And, you know, peer-to-peer technology clearly is still here. And so is the internet. But those were a lot of discussions. For example, if there was something that was posted on YouTube or eBay, they would have to notify the platform, hey, I have something, I own this, I didn't give them permission. And that platform would have to take it down. And you had to protect online service providers so that they could continue to provide the service. But once notified, also help to protect individual rights. So that was the balance at the time, to create legal frameworks to protect good actors. And I'm saying all of this for a reason, right? Protect those legitimate actors in the space to continue to support the innovation while also protecting, at the time, creatives. And we could borrow that same concept in this space. And I think that's going to be a necessary component. So it doesn't have to be all bad all the time. It's give the innovators and the platform operators who legitimately just want to support exchanges or marketplaces the opportunity to do so and to help them follow the law in a way that protects consumers and investors.
And that echoes your testimony before Congress. I was so grateful to see you testifying before Congress, because there is the perception that we're all just a bunch of crazy people. And no, we're not. And that analogy, I just learned something important from you yet again. I hadn't thought about the Napster and Sony analogies on legitimate and illegitimate uses. And maybe this is a great way to wrap it up. We're dealing with now the US government going after some of the open source software developers. And I think the distinction that folks on social media might not be catching is the difference between free speech, in other words, writing the software, versus using that software commit a crime. And if someone has used that software to commit a crime, then I think you and I would agree that especially if it was fraud, then I think you and I would agree that the prosecution is legitimate. But everyone naturally just assumes that it's having written the code that was what the person is being prosecuted for. Maybe we can wrap up on that thought.
Yeah, I think it's a really important point to leave listeners with. It is, you know, technology in most instances, unless it is purely created to do harm, that it is agnostic. It is a tool that can be used either for good or for evil. And in most cases where it was created for a legitimate purpose, let's use the example of electronic mail. And then all of a sudden you're getting emails to send $1 million to someone in some faraway country. We didn't throw away email because someone was using it for a nefarious purpose. We have to continue to remind legislators of that point and users.
Yeah, it's a great way to wrap up. Thank you, Professor Evans. As always, it's awesome to spend time with you. And we will continue to fight the good fight to break through the legitimate players while helping the legitimate law enforcement uses and crack down on this technology for the criminals who are unfortunately making it hard for the good players.
Agreed. Thank you so much. And yes, let's continue the good fight. Thank you so much for listening to the Tech Intersect podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you love it, please tell the world. If not, go ahead and tell me. And in either case, drop a comment or ping me on social media at IPProfEvans with the hashtag Tech Intersect. And finally, a quick reminder on digital safety. There are a lot of scammers out there impersonating me and others, and I need your help. Now hear this, and remember, I will never slide into your DMs to say peace and blessings or hey, and I will never reach out to solicit your time or your money on social media, like ever. I'm not a trader. I am an educator and an attorney licensed in 4 states. Thank you very much. I'm here to inform, inspire, and empower. No cap. And definitely no Forex. So be careful, make good choices, and remember, I developed an entire free masterclass about the topic of digital safety in the crypto space. So check out secureyourcryptobag.com for more information. That's secureyourcryptobag.com. All right, that's all for this episode. Until next time, continue to shine.